This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
Keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton again, and you're listening to Night Transmissions. 2 hours of old-time radio and more. I want to tell you about our first program. Syndicated by 12 Ways, Strange Wills was an interesting twist on the mystery drama of the late 1940s. Conceived by both 12 Ways and the star Warren Williams, New at the time was a stage and film actor of some significance, but is little remembered now except for the occasional 1930s film aficionado, who will remember him fondly as Perry Mason in 4 Warner Brothers features between 1934 and 1936. The premise of the series is the investigation of the interesting and often overlooked drama that arises from many last wills and testaments. Warren William provides the first-person narrative of these legal entanglements as either the attorney of record or an interested investigator of the often complex underpinnings of some extraordinary will. From October the 5th of 1946, The Miner's Gold. It's the story of an old man who shows up in a lawyer's office with a bag of gold. I think he called the bag of gold Alice. There is also his sad story of his cold and greedy family, and his plans for revenge spread thick.
Strange Wills. Starring the distinguished Hollywood actor, Warren William, and featuring Loreen Tuttle and Leo Cleary, with Howard Culver and an all-star Hollywood cast. Original music by Del Castillo.
Dead men's wills are often strange. We cannot attempt to understand them or try to find the answers. We can but tell the story. Miser's Gold.
Of all the strange, weird characters I've had the pleasure to represent in probate matters, none, I think, ever can measure up to the caliber of Old Nick, gold miner extraordinary. I saw him for the first time on a cold March morning when he came up to my office for legal advice. He wore neither hat nor overcoat, and his toes, blue with cold, were sticking out of his broken shoes. He was a
hat. I'm an old man, sick man, and I want to know what happens to your money when you kick the bucket.
Well, Nick, under the law, it goes to your next of kin. If you have a wife and children...
But I ain't got no wife and kids.
Well, then to your blood relatives. That is, of course, if you die without making a will.
And if I make a will?
Then to whomsoever you name as beneficiaries, Nick.
I only got one sister and 2 brothers.
Well, you've answered your own question.
But I don't want them to get my money. I hate them.
Well, how about some charity?
No. I ain't going to give my money to no strangers here.
Well, Nick, one thing is certain. If you have any money, you can't very well take it with you, can you?
No, that's right. I can't take it with me. But then, I ain't going to give it to no strangers. I don't want... I'll think it over, Mr. O'Connell. I'll think it over. Now, how much do I owe you?
Owe me? For that small consultation? Nothing, Nick.
No, Mr. Connell, that ain't how I do my business. I pays for what I get. I'll take this paper bag and keep what's in it. And when I make up my mind, Mr. Connell, I'll get in touch with you.
Very well, Nick. Good day to you.
Bye, Mr. Connell. Bye.
After Nick had left the office, I untied the string around the little paper bag he'd given me. It felt like a bag of sand. Maybe old Nick was a beachcomber. I poured the contents out on my desk. Quilt sealed. It couldn't be true. But there it was.
Yes, Mr. O'Connell?
Marie, has that old character gone?
Yes, I'm still fumigating the room.
Come in here, Marie. Well, I'll be blessed.
Were you asphyxiated, too?
Look here on this paper.
Don't tell me, let me guess. Well, at least it looks like gold.
Right, Marie. A little paper bag full of pure gold dust. That old codger gave it to me. And he looked like a pauper.
It smelled worse. Who is he? Why the gold?
Well, that's the strange part of it. Would you believe it, Marie, if I told you?
Tell me what, Mr. O'Connell?
Well, I only know him by the name of Nick. I don't even know where he lives. But as it turned out, that wasn't the last of old Nick. One morning, Marie came running into my office.
It's a postcard from that character that came in to see you.
Huh?
We know his last name now. It's Nick Bowler. And we know where he lives, too.
Here, give it to me. Here, Mr. O'Connell, I thought over what you told me. I want you to come to my shack tonight. Take Silver Canyon Road to end. Then stop. And you'll see a path that goes up mountain. You'll have to walk the rest of the way. I live on the top of the mountain. You can't miss it. I want to make a will. Nick Bowler. Later that night, Marie and I set out for Nick's shack in the mountains. Who was this Nick Bowler? Had he more gold? Well, that seemed to be the inevitable conclusion. In any event, the next few hours would be decided.
Well, Mr. O'Connell, you've already had your bag of gold. Maybe after I transcribe all of your notes tonight, you'll give me one, too, huh?
Maybe. But don't have any high hopes, Marie. This Nick is certainly a crackpot. Maybe he won't have a dime.
Probably gave you his life savings.
But how do you think he ever got the gold dust?
Oh, maybe he's a prospector. Well, here we are. This looks like the end of the road.
Oh, Nick said when you get here, right here, to stop.
We couldn't go farther if we wanted to. Now then, now let's find that path.
Oh, I never knew there was such a deserted place in the whole world.
Well, it's dark, isn't it? Now I'll turn on my flashlight.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's the path. See over there to the right?
Yeah, that must be it, all right. Well, are you ready for a good climb, Marie?
I didn't wear these pedal pushers for nothing. Oh, but this mountain looks awfully high.
And steep, too. But let's get going.
How about resting for a minute? This is the charge of the light brigade, you know.
Phew. Yes, maybe you're right.
Isn't there any end to this?
We must be near the top. Can't be much farther.
Suppose I give out with a few yoo-hoos. Maybe you'll hear us and show us a shortcut.
Not a bad idea. Try it.
Hello? Hello?
Well, that ought to wake the dead. Let's see if he heard us.
Who? Listen to those dogs.
Hey, wait a minute. This might be serious. They're coming this way.
I think this is where we start our return trip.
We couldn't make a car before they caught up to us.
Yes, but we might be able to get up in this tree.
All right, quick. Oh. Here, give me your foot.
Take them both. But get
now
me
then,
up there.
Now then, up you go.
Oh, I'm up. Now you hurry.
Here, up
get
I
your
come.
Head. Pop it. Get up here.
Here I come. Ah, just in time, too.
Must be old Nick.
Well, here we are, Nick. Up here in this tree.
The dogs must have got when they heard a woman's voice. See, they don't like women.
I'm about as popular as a polecat.
Just a moment, Nick. I'll jump down. I brought my secretary along to take notes, Nick. Miss Humphrey.
Yeah.
You know Nick, of course.
Well, if one of you gentlemen would please disengage me from this tree.
I'm sorry. Here, give me your hand.
Oh, for the days of Sir Walter Raleigh.
Now then, down you come.
Ooh. I'm glad you got here, Mr. O'Connell, both of you. Let me lead the way. It ain't fur from here.
Well, Marie, are you ready to begin climbing again?
Lead on, McDuff. After this workout, I'll be ready to play ball with the Dodgers.
Well, folks, here we are.
So, this is where you live, Nick.
Yeah.
No wonder you haven't any neighbors.
Only got one. He lives about a mile away. See, I don't live very fancy like. It's just a one-room shack on the mountaintop.
It ought to be nice and breezy.
High on a windy hill.
Sometimes I think the wind like to blow me in the shack right down the mountain. Well, let's go in and get down to brass tacks.
After you, Marie.
Well, chair, table, and a pile of bags.
Yeah, not much furniture, but then I can only sit on one chair at a time.
Marie, be a good girl and park yourself on a sandbag.
Oh, I'm going to be ducky.
Now then, Nick, we're ready to go to work.
I never told you much, Mr. O'Connell, the day I come to your office.
Well, suppose you tell me now just what you have to will away and who you want to get it.
I got a sister. Her name is Sarah. And two brothers, Herman and Otto.
Getting this, Marie?
Heirs at law, next of kin. Sister Sarah, brothers Herman and Otto.
Yeah, that's right. My sister was married. Her husband died. Name is Stevens. Now, she and my brothers all live in town.
Say, before we take inventory, I wish you'd pardon me just a minute while I try making the sandbag a little more comfortable. It doesn't dent very easily. It feels more like concrete than sand.
That's my ballast, miss. It helps to keep my house from blowing off the mountain. Hold up there. Give me a hand there.
Thank you.
Don't know if you noticed, but there are 10 bags, and each one's got a name.
Oh, you named the sandbags, too.
Yep. This one's Evelyn. And that one's Gert, and you're sitting on Mert.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mert.
And below is Hattie, Alice, and Marty.
Those are your girls, eh, Nick?
Not exactly, Mr. O'Connell, but they're the only women I ever knew. I just like them. Yep, each guy's got a name. Here, I'll show you why. Pardon me, miss, I'll open up Mercer. Put that paper on the floor, eh, miss?
Well,
put it right
paper
there.
Paper on the floor.
That's it.
Now, what's coming up?
Look.
Gold.
It's yellow. It's... Oh, no, I'm seeing things.
No, you ain't. It's gold. Every last bag is filled with gold. Yeah, look at her run.
Later, when I recovered my composure and Marie got over her shock, Nick told me his story.
You want to know how I got my gold? I'll tell you. In my family, I was always the dumb one. My brothers and sisters would laugh at me because I couldn't get no place in school.
Oh, well, you certainly had the last laugh, Nick.
And when my father died, he left his business to my two brothers, Herman and Otto, his house and money to my sister. And to me, he just gave me a mule. A mule that he used in his business. Her name was Annabella. Well, I took Annabella and went into the mountains. Nobody said goodbye. They was glad to get rid of me. One night I camped by a mountain stream. I was downright lonely, hungry, and sick of living. Annabella had wandered off to look for grass, and then... Annabella! What's the matter? Wait, Annabella, I'm coming. Oh, there you are. Now, let's see what this number is. Quiet, will you? Now, so you cut your halter rope on a rock, eh? Well, keep your dander down, and I'll have you loose in 2 shakes. Pretty tight. Come on, Annabella. We'll have to pull together now. Come on. I had to pull half the mountain off to get you loose. Now, be a good girl and bed yourself down. Annabella! Look! Where the stone came out. It's gold. Gold, Annabella. We've hit pay dirt. You see, sand full of pure gold.
And in these bags, Nick, is what you got out of your placer mine?
Yeah, Mr. O'Connell, I filled 10 bags with gold, I did. And then it ran out. But it was enough. Took me over 5 years to get. Every night when I came in from the diggings, I'd let the gold dust run through my fingers. And when I filled each bag, I'd give it a name, kind of like a friend.
I wish I had some friends like that, Nick. I'd settle for even one.
Marie.
Hmm? Old girl can wish, can't she?
Well, then my mule, Arabella, died. Buried her next to the mine. Got kind of lonesome and figured I'd pay a visit to my kin folks. Thought maybe the years had softened them up. I was ready to share my gold if they was decent to me. I went down to the city...
We haven't anything for tramps.
But I ain't a tramp. Sarah, don't you know me?
Know you? Why, you're Nick.
Yes, Sarah. I'm your brother, Nick.
Well, what do you want?
I thought I'd sort of pay you a visit, sir. I'm rich now.
You rich? Oh, you're crazier than ever. Now, wait a minute here. Take this $5 bill and go away. We don't want you to disgrace our family name.
But, Sherry, don't you understand?
I don't want to understand any more than I can see. Take the money and go away now before I change my mind.
All right, Sarah. All right, I'll go. But here, take your money. I don't need it. But news about my strike spread like wildfire through the town, especially when I paid my bills in gold. My brother Herman finally ran into me one day on the news.
You can't imagine how glad we all are to know that you're well and rich. Good to see you.
Yeah, Herman, I done all right.
We want you to come to dinner tonight. We'll all be there to kill the fatted calf.
Dinner? Yeah, but Herman, Sarah told me I...
Then you must tell us all about your gold. Maybe all of us can share in your good fortune. Hey, Nick? After all, we are your blood relatives. Sure, come on over for dinner. About 7, huh, Nick?
All right, Herman. I'll see you all tonight. I got to Herman's house a little before 7. It's getting dark. I walked along the side of the house and passed by an open window. Inside, I could see my two brothers and Sarah. They were talking.
You made arrangements for the judge, Otto.
Now, Sarah, everything is taken care of. After he leaves here tonight, he'll be picked up as a vagrant. Isn't that right, Herman?
Yes. The judge promised to give him a hearing right away.
Uh-huh.
And see that he's committed to an asylum.
Yes. And Otto, as soon as we find out where he lives, we'll just go out there and take possession.
Of course. Meantime, one of us will get appointed as conservator at his estate. Does that mean anything to you, Sarah?
It will if we can find his gold. He must have a lot of it hidden away somewhere. We'll find out where it is.
Nick was always too dumb to be rich anyway. Just like that mule Father willed him. Remember?
Oh, that mule.
I come back to the hills, and I ain't never seen them since.
Well, Nick, I can't really blame you for not wanting to leave them your fortune. But if you don't, it'll have to go to other people.
I know. For 6 months, night and day, I've been trying to figure a way of giving it to them, and still making sure they can't spend it.
Huh?
But I guess it can't be done. They're bound to get it one way or another. I want you to make my will. I'm giving my kinfolks everything. I'll take care of the rest. I'll take care of the rest.
Realizing that Nick was really a very sick man, I lost no time in preparing his will and taking it out to his shack for his signature. As I neared the top of the mountain...
Hello, Nick. Hello, Nick, where are you?
Oh, go right in the shack, Mr. O'Connell. I'm just fixing things up underneath here. I'll be right up.
Fixing things, eh? Well, this place could stand a little fixing.
You got my will?
Yes, I've got it.
Good, then. Let's get it over with.
Old Nick must have had a premonition of what was coming, because just a few days later, he was found dead in his cabin by his only friend and neighbor on the mountain. His neighbor called me immediately, as Nick had instructed him to do. After reporting Nick's death to the proper authorities, I called his sister Sarah.
Yes?
Are you Mrs. Sarah Stevens?
Yes. Who is this, and what do you want?
This is John Francis O'Connell, attorney at law. You have a brother named Nick?
Yes. What about it?
He asked me to call you as soon as I was informed of his death.
Death? Dead? Where?
I am informed that he died sometime during the night. A neighbor found his body this morning.
Oh, where?
In his house. He lived in a little shack on top of a mountain at the end of Silver Canyon Road.
Did he turn over anything to you?
No, nothing has been turned over. That, of course, will have to be done through legal channels.
Well, now, look here. He was our brother, wasn't he? What he had belongs to us. Herman, Otto, and me are his only relatives.
Yes, I know.
He bought immediately and take possession of his property. The end of Silver Canyon Road, you say?
I wouldn't advise that, for two reasons. First, certain legal steps will have to be taken. The coroner will have to examine the body and Then provision will have to be made.
All right. So you've advised us. You've done your duty. But just let someone try and stop us from going. What he's got belongs to us, and Mr. We aim to get it.
Well, what a charming female. I could see greed coming right out of the telephone.
I wonder why old Nick insisted that you call her as soon as he found out he was dead. Because Finchie didn't want those three vultures to get his gold that way.
No, he should have known there'd be no stopping them once they heard the news.
No stopping them is right. I bet they're on the way right now.
I wonder, Marie. I wonder if old Nick didn't want them to get there first.
What?
But why?
Well, what did he say the last time you saw him? How did he feel about it the day you went out there to have him sign his will?
Well, he didn't say anything. Felt fine as far as I could see. Yes, I remember. He was all smiles. Had a saw in his hand when I met him.
What was he doing? Trimming the scrubber?
He might have been trimming his beard for all I know. Wait a minute. Marie, wait a minute.
What's the matter, Mr. O'Connell? You look sick.
I am sick, Marie. Get your hat and coat.
Oh, wait a minute. What's
no
the matter?
No time to talk now. Come on. We've got a trip to make, and every second counts. Why can't this car go faster? Why can't it...
You're already making 72. What do you expect when you're climbing a mountain?
Faster, faster. We've got to go faster. Almost. Almost up to the top, Marie.
Oh.
Don't give up.
Got to make it. Boy, you've got to.
Look. Look, the shack is still there. It's still there.
Oh, thank heaven.
Come on, let's run for it.
Yeah. I'm right behind you. We'll make it.
There goes the shack. We're too late. There's old Nick's answer, just as I feared.
You were right. Oh, how horrible, Miss O'Connor. I can't believe it.
Marie, Nick knew that if I had any inkling of his mad plan, I would have stopped it.
But how did he ever manage to have the shack tumble down the mountainside just when his two brothers and sister were in it?
His family may have called him the dumb one, but in reality, Nick was shrewd and crafty.
Mm-hmm.
He knew all about the stress and strain of timbers from his experience working his mine. He knew, too, that Sarah, Herman, and Otto were greedy.
Oh, yes.
That they would rush out to his shack to find his hoard of gold the minute I let them know old Nick was dead. And if you remember... Nick insisted, time and time again, that they should be notified immediately.
Mm-hmm.
We know now that Nick sawed into and weakened the supports that held his shack to the mountainside and waited for his greedy relatives to bring him the revenge he so wanted.
Oh.
Well, they came, all right. They stormed into the shack and began tearing everything apart looking for the gold. Their combined weight brought their own destruction. The supports collapsed, and the shack with its unholy three crashed down the mountainside.
And it seems to me they were all guilty of one sin or another.
Every one of them. And how unnecessary. If Sarah would only have listened, I would have told her that Nick had made a will and left everything to them. There was no necessity for their mad race to destruction. Well, that's about all. You know the rest of it.
All but one thing. When did you first realize what old Nick was up to?
Oh, it suddenly dawned on me the morning in the office. I remembered then that the day Nick signed his will, I heard the sound of a saw.
Oh?
And then... I recalled how anxious he was to have me notify his relatives as soon as he died. Too late, I saw the plan of his revenge.
He really got his revenge, didn't he?
Yes, but not entirely. Sarah and Herman died, of course, but Otto survived the fall. And eventually, he will get the entire fortune. You see, Marie, old Nick never learned that two wrongs don't make a right. This is Warren Williams, inviting you to listen again next week.
Strange Wills is a Teleways feature produced in Hollywood. Any similarity between names used on this broadcast and those of living persons is purely coincidental.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Haunted House by Virginia Woolf, read by Howard Dratch. Whatever hour you woke, there was a door shunting. From room to room they went, hand in hand, lifting here, opening there, making sure, a ghostly couple. Here we left it, she said, and he added, oh, but here too, it's upstairs, she murmured, and in the garden, he whispered. Quietly, they said, oh, we shall wake them, but it wasn't that you woke us, oh no. They're looking for it, they're drawing the curtain, one might say, and so read on a page or two. Now they've found it, one would be certain, stopping the pencil in the margin. And then, tired of reading, one might rise and see for oneself the house all empty, the doors standing open, only the wood pigeons bubbling with content, and the hum of the threshing machine sounding from the farm. What did I come in here for? What did I want to find? My hands were empty. Perhaps it's upstairs then. The apples were in the loft, and so down again. The garden still as ever, only the book had slipped into the grass. But they had found it in the drawing room, not that one could ever see them. The window panes reflected apples, reflected roses, all the leaves were green in the glass. If they moved in the drawing room, the apple only turned its yellow side. Yet the moment after, if the door was opened, spread about the floor, hung upon the walls, pendant from the ceiling, what? My hands were empty. The shadow of a thrush crossed the carpet. From the deepest wells of silence, the wood pigeon drew its bubble of sound. Safe, 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 the pulse of the house beat softly. The treasure buried the room. The pulse stopped short. Oh, was that the buried treasure? A moment later, the light had faded. Out in the garden, then? But the trees spun darkness for a wandering beam of sun. So fine, so rare, coolly sunk beneath the surface, the beam I sought always burnt behind the glass. Death was the glass. Death was between us, coming to the woman first, hundreds of years ago, leaving the house, sealing all the windows, the rooms were darkened. He left it, left her, went north, went east, saw the stars turned in the southern sky, sought the house, found it dropped beneath the downs. Safe, 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 the pulse of the house beat gladly, the treasure yours. The wind roars up the avenue. Trees stoop and bend this way and that. Moonbeams splash and spill wildly in the rain. But the beam of the lamp falls straight from the window. The candle burns stiff and still. Wandering through the house, opening the windows, whispering not to wake us, the ghostly couple seeks their joy. Here we slept, she says, and he adds, kisses without number, waking in the morning, silver between the trees, upstairs in the garden, when summer came, in winter snowtime, the doors go shutting far in the distance, gently knocking like the pulse of a heart. Nearer they come, cease at the doorway. The wind falls, the rain slides silver down the glass. Our eyes darken, we hear no steps beside us. We see no lady spread her ghostly cloak. His hands shield the lantern. Look, he breathes, sound asleep, love upon their lips. Stooping, holding their silver lamp above us, long they look and deeply, long they pause. The wind drives straightly, the flame stoops slightly. Wild beams of moonlight cross both floor and wall, and meeting, stain the faces bent. The faces pondering, the faces that search the sleepers and seek their hidden joy. Safe, 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 the heart of the house beats proudly. Long years, he sighs. Again you found me. Here, she murmurs, sleeping in the garden, reading, laughing, rolling apples in the loft. Here we left our treasure. Stooping, their light lifts the lids upon my eyes. Safe, safe, safe. The pulse of the house beats wildly. Waking, I cry, oh, is this your buried treasure? The light in the heart? End of A Haunted House by Virginia Woolf, read by Howard Dratch.
I'm in love with a man who's in love with the taste of a Big Mac.
He's a Big Mac man.
He insists nothing else can compare with the taste.
Big Mac man.
Into all these patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, on a sesame seed bun, if you please.
Nothing else has a chance with him, you see.
I'm a man who loves Big Mac.
And me.
It's a good time for the great taste of McDonald's.
Next, from sometime in the 1970s, it's hard to be sure, no good records appear to have been kept on this program, is the inimitable Vincent Price in the terrific BBC production.
The Price of Fear.
Morris Denham and Liz Fraser in The Family Album by William Ingram.
Hello and welcome. Meet my friend Arthur, Arthur Goodby. Arthur is your ordinary, very ordinary, ordinary man. The kind of man one simply passes in the street. The kind of man at a ticket barrier one squeezes past and perhaps, ever so gently, curses at. Such a man is Arthur Goodby. Only a few very intimates are even aware of his existence, and yet, in his home life, even this ordinary, very ordinary, ordinary man has his hidden depths. Depths too deep to fathom.
Well, to my man's liking, was it?
First off, hope you haven't robbed your Arthur, though.
You let me worry about my Arthur. Well, say thank you nicely, then.
Oh, I just did.
Nicely was what I said.
Rose.
Artie, why, Artie, what...
Oh, don't start, Rose.
You didn't know what I was getting myself in for right from the start. Oh, everything in the garden when you first moved in here.
At your invitation?
At Arthur's invitation. Poor, simple, good-natured Arthur, eh? Rose, meet my good friend Harry, one of the very best, but presently without a roof over his head, and with that spare room of ours just collecting cobwebs.
Well, I was very grateful to Arthur.
I bet you were. But I wonder how grateful Arthur would be if he'd ever got out that spare room wasn't the only thing that took his young friend fancy.
What?
He may seem simple, but I shouldn't count on his good nature running to that extent.
You wouldn't dare.
Who said anything about daring? Not a word from these lips, I should hope. Not a single, little word.
Oh, he could walk through that door any minute.
Oh, not a chance.
Oh, for God's sake.
Friday night, isn't it?
So,
always an hour later of a Friday, he's usually a stop-off at his Mr. Martin.
Oh, I was forgetting.
Creature of habit, my Arthur.
Thanks all for creatures of habit.
Oh.
Mr. Martin? You there? Anyone at home? Come.
Ah, oh, there you are, my good friend.
Yeah, I hope it's not inconvenient.
No.
I have just about given you up, though. Oh, the rush hour, I'm afraid, even worse than usual. You're a lucky man not to know it firsthand.
Oh, I am.
I know I am. Got me and my shop and as many beautiful reminders of the past as I can afford to lay my hands on. And I know which particular beauty brought you visiting. You spotted it in the window, eh? Yes, but the reserve tag is...
My good friend, who else?
Ah,
who else but my good friend, Mr. Goodby, shall have the refusal.
Well, that's very kind.
Let me show you. A large country house sale this very morning. And though I see to myself as fine a family album as you've ever likely to see it. Well, a beauty, eh?
Ah, beautiful.
You feel the weight. There.
Ah, yes.
Real gilt lettering on the hand-tooled leather.
Family album.
Craftsmanship, eh? You see the solid brown cloth?
Yes. Arthur. That's to keep out the nosy body intruders.
Oh, may I look inside?
For you, I think I can make this set.
Oh, the family album of William James Willoughby.
So it's only fitting his photograph should have pride of place.
Yes, how proud he looks.
Fine figure of a man, yes. Dressed for the hunt. Want to stand? Shotgun, hooked in his arm.
Yes, like he'd put a bullet into anybody that dared to venture further.
Oh, and then just empty pages.
Yes, it seems those nosy body intruders got their way after all.
As you say.
Well, what can I say?
Just what you'd set your heart on for so long.
Oh, certainly that. Your turn, knock down price.
Oh, well, that's very good of you.
But I tell you what. You take it with you now and work out what you think it's worth. And then drop the money in next time you're passing.
Well, if you're sure.
No trust between old friends. No trust at all. Besides, high time to put the shutters up and your lovely wife at home waiting your return. Dinner waiting to be served. Slippers by the hearth. If you're now an old bachelor, the liberty of saying so. A man to be envied.
Oh, yes, Mr. Martin. I suppose most people would consider me a very lucky man.
Well, I...
Yes, well, I think it's very nice, Arthur. Something, well, a bit different. Know what I mean?
Leave it, Harry, for God's sake. Make enough of an idiot of himself without you trying to put him in the right.
Sorry?
Talk about a load of rubbish.
Well, I just took a fancy to it.
I bet you did. No wonder old Martin keeps that junk shop of his open every Friday night till God knows what hour. But his face lights up every time his shop bell tings.
Oh, I never quite considered it in that light, dear.
Consider? Consider it is the last thing that comes into it from where I'm standing. Pass it your plate.
I suppose I could always take it back.
You can do what you ruddy like, Sonny Jim. Either that or it's down that shed with the rest of the rubbish. One thing's for sure, you're not catching me giving it house room.
I see. It is a lovely bit of craftsmanship, Rose.
And the last thing I need is you ganging up on me.
Oh, it's just remarkable.
Then don't. Morbid is what I call it. Family album. But minus the family, it would seem.
I had thought, we could always start taking some of our own.
Oh, no. Not what's the birdie time again. Do you know, Harry, last time he tried that caver, he spent a fortune on snaps that either didn't turn out or looked as if they'd been taken down the wrong end of a telescope. Morbid is what I called it. My final word on the matter. Well, if you've quite finished, I'll make a start with the washing up.
I'll give you hands.
I deny.
Not yet.
No?
I've got something to tell you.
Not two surprises in one night. You know Harry's got a weak heart. He'll never stand it.
Go on, then, Arthur. Well, I've got me a... that's to say, I've got us. A car. A car?
I don't believe it. I honestly don't.
A car, Arthur? No, nothing special. Not new, but not that old, neither.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, just a little runabout.
But you can't even drive, Arthur.
Drive? The old fool's as blind as a bat. Have us up the nearest tree before we got as far as the corner.
Harry can, though.
Me? You want me to go along with you?
Well, yes, Harry, of course. Did you think different? Now, trips, you see, trips. Just the three of us, a regular family outing, eh? Oh, yeah. I'm sure we'd all enjoy that.
And Arthur was right about that. So they must have appeared a somewhat odd threesome. Poor Arthur, relegated to the back seat, Rose, head scarved and bubbling up front, and young Harry at the wheel, showing off a bit like any kid on the fairground bumpers. Young Harry. But quite old enough to know better. Oh, it all seemed a very civilized arrangement in theory, anyway.
the most cordial of relationships, with Rose always at the center, a feeling of sharing, each after their fashion, some prized possession. They never referred to it directly, of course. Nothing is blunt. It was enough to bask in the secret knowledge of it, like the sun and the sea on that warm summer's day.
Arthur, she's waving.
What?
Well, Rose, look, can you spot her?
No, I can't say.
Here, have a go with the glasses.
Ah.
No, 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 more to the right.
Mm.
Hey, she must be halfway to the point, for God's sake.
Ah, so she is. She's waving. Well, way back then. She'll expect you to wave back. That's right. Coffee?
Oh, sir. What the hell did she want to go all that way for?
Out of her depth, eh? Quite right, young Harry. You should never get out of your depth. Anyway, panic over. She's swimming back now.
Oh, thank God for that.
Worried, were we? Oh, you must never worry, Harry. Not as far as my Rosie's concerned. Never pay to worry.
Well, as you say, son.
Oh, I do, I do. Well, should know her by now, I should hope. Should know my own wife by now, eh? After so many years. In the matter, eh?
Yeah.
Anyway, you must know pretty well all there is to know about Rose and me by now.
Well,
ups and downs, young Harry. A difference in age? Bound to happen, wouldn't you say?
Well, if you say so.
Oh, I do, I do. You take my word for it. Still, knew what I was letting myself in for when I popped the question. Oh, she took a bit of persuading, I can tell you. Well, if you look at it from Rosie's point of view, not much on offer.
Hmm?
Not much to write home about, as the saying goes. Comfortable little nesting in the bank, regular job. Prospects, even.
Hmm.
If I played my cards right, eh? But never a great one for card playing, young Harry. Not enough skill, but short on deception. A much better stick to your limits, leave the high stakes for them that can afford them, eh?
Hmm?
Would you agree, young Harry?
Tuck at the towel, one of you, I'm frozen.
Ah, that's my old Rosebank. Quite the mermaid, eh?
You haven't seen all the coffee off.
We'll record it for her, will you, Harry? I'd like to get a snapshot when she thinks we're not looking.
Okay. Lovely when you get in. God only knows what state my hair's going to be in.
Rose here, watch the birdie. I got you.
Oh, bloody hell. Just another one for that damn family album.
And another for the album it was. There were many, many more other ones. Rose sometimes prinking and preening straight into the lens, sometimes deliberately pouting away from the shutter. Harry beside her, his expression seldom changing, pleasant but set, resigned, almost part of the furniture. As for Arthur, Arthur clicked away quite merrily, regardless of mood or circumstance. But the surprising thing was, he never showed them the results. If badgered, he'd just shrug it off and smile.
Patience, patience. When the great day dawns and my album is complete, you shall be the first invited to its unveiling.
In the weeks that followed, Arthur's shed became a kind of refuge. This increasing absence from hearth and home, if noted at all, caused neither concern or comment. It was as he wanted it.
Arthur! Arthur, you in there?
Here's Rose, will you?
Oh, no, no, she's up in the house. Raising out about our supper's getting cold. Arthur!
Oh, just a minute, I'll let you in.
Blimey. Talk about a Bank of England.
Well, just in case the vandals.
Yeah. So, what particular interest kept you burning the midnight oil tonight?
Nothing in particular. I would just...
No. No need to explain, old mate. See for myself. Well, well. Another session on the old family album, eh? Catching up on the Rogues Gallery. Anywhere near publication date, are we?
How about a bit of a preview, eh?
I'd rather you didn't.
Stop just a little, please.
No, please.
Oh, this sport. Not a word to Rose, promise.
Well, as you please.
Well?
Well, indeed.
Yeah, I did warn you they were.
See, you're still letting Squire William James Willoughby keep his pride of place at the front.
It is his album.
Was?
Seems a bit of a disturbance.
Oh, as you say, as you say.
Well?
Oh, guess better as you go on. But, well, got to admit, made a bit of a botch of these early ones, Arthur, mate. Double exposure.
No.
Well, it was something to do with printing. If I were you...
I developed them myself.
Could explain it. No offense.
Look closer. Catch here. Ooh. There's it.
At your point.
Unpleasant.
A bit like
fungus.
They're fungus. But only on these early ones, eh?
So far.
You see up here on this shelf, dear?
And just where you're looking.
Oh, it explains it then, doesn't it? You got damp up there, Arthur, old mate.
Damp? But...
Wrap it in newspaper, tuck it away in a cup. That should do the trick.
You really think so?
Sure so.
Harry! Arthur! Where the devil have you both got to?
Just coming!
Oh, Harry, no need to let Rose in on all this. It's still supposed to come as a nice surprise.
Mum's the word, old mate. Mum is the word.
Thank you.
The last little outing they ever took was a visit to a bird sanctuary. As a matter of fact, it was Arthur's idea, though it seemed an obvious choice. Besides, the seclusion of the place was bound to have its advantages. Daffy old Arthur could plod off with his government surplus binoculars to spy on his feathered friends, leaving her with Harry, and more personal intimacy. It preoccupied them. In fact, it wasn't until early evening they began to think something might be up.
Well, Your Honor, we called and called for him, but no joy.
Joy?
Results, Your Honor.
This is a coroner's inquiry, Mr. Blake, not a court of law.
Your Honor?
Fair will suffice.
Oh, yes, sir.
So then what did you do?
We thought after Mr. Goodby might be playing a lark on us at first.
A lark?
Well, just at first. And then we went looking, didn't we? Though God knows, heaven knows, what chance we thought we had. I mean, all that undergrowth, reeds, not to mention the lake.
You could find no trace of them.
No, sir.
No sight, no sound out of the ordinary?
Nothing at all. Except for...
For what?
Gunshots. One right after the other. A double-barrel shotgun.
Are you sure of that?
Oh, not sure. Far from it. It's just the way it sounded. But as Rose, Mrs. Goodby said... Not very likely.
Oh?
Well, it's not the kind of thing you'd expect to hear in a bird sanctuary, is it? Not the kind of thing at all.
Well, please continue.
Nothing else. By then it was nearly dark. There was nothing more we could do on our own. So we got to the nearest telephone and called the police.
You may return to your seat.
Your Honor.
Therefore, having given due and careful consideration to the evidence concerning the sudden, unexplained disappearance of the said Arthur William Goodby, and in view of the fact that no remains had ever been recovered, or evidence to suggest intent or willful act of malice, I shall herewith return an open verdict, but not totally dismissing the inherent possibility of death by misadventure. This coroner's court is adjourned.
Poor tragic Rose, But, dear listener, I'm sure you can well imagine the scene.
The most wonderful of husbands in the whole wide world.
Yes, Rose.
Nothing I wouldn't have done for my Arthur. You know that.
Of course, Rose.
Well, you've lessened a lot, of course, you see. Nothing but the very best for my Rose. Some of the times I've heard him say that. Now that he's gone, stand to reason. Well, Great Expectations time, eh, Harry, love?
Great Expectations.
But the mutual expectations proved short-lived. Rose was right about copying the lot, of course, but she certainly hadn't bargained on a recent hefty mortgage Arthur had saddled her with. His bank account also seemed to indicate dear deceased Arthur had treated himself to something of a spree in his latter years.
The rotten, timing! Oh, really been doing himself proud, hasn't he? Know what? He probably had some fancy woman shut away under my very nose.
Arthur, calm off it, love.
How the hell would we know? Explain why he was always that late every Friday, wouldn't it? Splashing out on some damn cart while dear darling Rose held the fort.
And found whatever poor bit of consolation she could.
What?
Nothing. Nothing that matters.
But it did. Amazing how Rose's change of circumstances affected Harry. His little treats, the odd prezi, became fewer and fewer. It eventually got so bad, she even suggested he get himself a job and help out with the housekeeping. The writing certainly seemed on the wall. What Arthur had spent the loot on continued to puzzle him, though. The secret affair Rose credited him with? Pie in the sky. There'd been no sudden change in lifestyle, so where the hell? Then it dawned on him. The shed. The stuff in the shed. They'd seen bits and pieces, but for all anybody knew, they could be sitting on a fortune. But why they? It didn't take Harry long to drop the plural notion of things. Well, he'd earned it, hadn't he? Had it coming to him, didn't he? His chance came a couple of nights later. The night of the storm. Such a storm. There'd been nothing like it since the night he'd barged in on Arthur in the garden shed. It was the memory of that night that took Harry to the living room window now. And as he peered through into the night, he saw it. A light on. Down there, in the shed, slanting through the dirty panes onto the lawn. And even at this distance, Harry could see the door was ajar, almost invitingly ajar. It could be he'd underestimated Rose. Perhaps she had come to the same conclusion as he had, was down there now, taking stock, making plans, about to leave him high and dry.
Hello? Anyone in there? Rose? You back? Rose? Is that you in there? Rose?
And then Harry saw it. Sat under the swinging lamp. In the very center of Arthur's work table, the family album. It drew Harry to it like a magnet.
Oh, my God. My dear God.
Open at the first page, and the eyes of the original owner, long dead but caught forever, staring out at him. The eyes of the dead, straight from the grave, staring out at him from a slime of maggot-ridden putrescence. And from those eyes, a fungus-like growth, smearing itself, obliterating the snapshot images of those strangers who had dared to invade the rest of its pages.
Rose at the seaside. Harry and Rose at picnic, Windsor Castle. Harry and Rose. Harry and Rose at the birds. At the bird sanctuary? But how? Like that very last day, but how? They never even started downtown. So how the hell?
It was the click that made Harry freeze. The unmistakable double click of a shotgun being cocked. In the age it took him to turn, he saw the thing that had once been a man, slowly raising the gun now, staring down the sightline. A man in an old-fashioned hunting costume, Norfolk jacket, and trousers tucked into gaiters. That dead socket of an eye staring down the sightline. A dribbling mouth, the cheekbones thrusting through the gray parchment of putrefied flesh. Oh, no. There was no mistaking the album's original owner.
William James Willoughby!
No! No! In the name of Jesus! No!
As far as Harry got. His heart beat now like some great animal trapped in his chest, a great insurmountable sea pounding, rolling through him, and finally dragging him down, ever down, into his unknown depth. Then it was over. He lay quite still, done, all done. Arthur waited a full minute to be sure, before he lowered the gun and removed the mask. And the figure that now knelt beside his dead friend's body bore no resemblance to that mottled harlequin of death.
I'm glad you didn't make me pull the trigger, Harry. Anyway, I doubt if I could have found it in me. But the album, the mask, quite works of art, wouldn't you say? No violence in me, though. No real violence. Not against you, dear friend. Not against Rose. Not even when I was forced to watch the two of you together. Me? Always cast in the role of poor old Arthur, eh? So gullible. So naive. So easy trick. Until that day at the sanctuary. Oh, poor, poor Harry.
Arthur climbed over the garden fence and took a shortcut over the fields. He buried his grotesque mask and period costume in a carefully prepared plot. From there, he continued on foot to a small suburban station where he took a train heading north. A very ordinary little man, one of the faceless ones. The powers that be decided Harry had suffered a heart attack, which he had. A year later, Rose found herself a new fancy man, sold the house, and moved to a different love nest. One day the new owners will find the album, mildewed, past saving. They'll make noises of disgust, handle it with gloves, and finally burn it on a bonfire. It's of no account. It had served its purpose.
That was The Family Album, starring Morris Denham as Arthur Goodby and Liz Fraser, Rose, with James Kerry as Harry, Aubrey Morris, Mr. Martin, and Anthony Newlands, the coroner.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call The Wrong Word. A rich industrialist named Wade paid a genealogist a huge sum of money to trace his family history and invited me to inspect the results. According to the genealogist, Wade was the descendant of an English earl. The genealogist showed a letter which included the quote, "Due to kaleidoscopic events taking place in the colony, I intend to leave England and join the forces of Washington and Liberty. The letter was dated 1777. I told Wade his family historian was a quack. In a moment, I'll tell you why.
Well, we're going to take a bit of a break right now, but we'll be back very soon with X minus one.
In the case of the wrong word, the expression kaleidoscopic events was used. The letter was dated 1777. It so happens the kaleidoscope was not invented until 1817, so the letter and the genealogist were fake. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Next is an X minus one from November the 28th of 1957. Shock Troop is based on Daniel Galloway's short story of the same name that was first published in the June of 1957 issue of Galaxy magazine. It's a clever story about a man who's threatened by germ-like creatures from another planet who are intending to take over, to colonize, to take him over. Sort of like some of the things I've been reading recently in Earth biology, where some parasites actually manage to invade the host nervous system and take over the body. There's the case of a kind of ant who is invaded by a kind of parasite that towards the end of its life cycle actually manages to take over the ant, drive it to some nearby body of water, have it jump in and drown. You see, the next stage of the parasite's life is an aquatic existence. So although this story is really intended to amuse, and the premise is far-fetched, it's maybe not quite as crazy as one would think at first.
Countdown for blast-off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Now, X minus one, and tonight's story, Shock Troop.
In all his seven major campaigns, Commander Zerum Lassen had never faced anything like this. First, there was the heat, agonizing, insufferable heat. Then there were the jolts, the convulsions. But most unbearable of all was the cross pulse. The interminable, monotonous thrump-thrump of the cross-pulse.
Come in. Hello, Barak. Close the bulkhead. This heat's driving me mad.
Zerium, I think we ought to abandon this project.
Abandon?
As chief psychotechnician, I recommend it.
Oh? On what do you base this?
This macroorganism is unlike anything we've ever tried to colonize before. It's much too complicated.
Complicated? Perak, I've colonized life forms on seven other worlds, and each time I've been advised to turn back.
I know your record, Zareen, but this creature is different.
How?
But for one thing, it has a highly organized psychoelectric system. The shock waves are fantastic. I've already lost three technicians.
These are shock troops. They know the risk.
And for another
Perak,
thing...
Perak, you're a fine scientist, but you're no leader of troops. This creature we've invaded will be subdued and brought under positive permanent control. We will achieve thermobiological conditioning to reduce the heat. We will achieve damping to muffle the crossbeat. and we will establish neuromuscular controls. And we will do all these things because I say we will. Now come along. We'll inspect the tunnels. Ready?
Yes. I'll open the bulkhead.
Phew, that heat.
Well, the thermo crews are doing everything they can to pull oxygen from the separators.
Tell them to work faster. What's the status of the control panel?
I'll see. Amandor, sir, what's the status of the control panel?
We've tapped the motor fibers 1 through 46, Chief. We'll be ready for the central selector hookup very soon.
What about optical auditory intercept?
We're still trying to tap into the subject's visual system, Commander. The screens are set up, but we haven't been able to run a line from the main circuit.
Why not?
The charge in the main trunks is too potent, sir. Our instruments won't take the surges of current.
Any installed transformers or resistances? Now get it down.
But, sir, two crews working in this heat would add noise.
I don't care about the heat or the noise. It is absolutely essential that we hook up visual intercept. I want you to...
Convulsions!
Hit the stanchions! Hang on!
It's passed.
I've never seen them quite this bad. How do you suppose causes them?
I don't know. I suspect their reflex actions.
Sir?
What?
Do you suppose this creature knows we're inside it?
Ceaselessly, the shock troops worked inside the host creature, burrowing through capillaries, tapping into nerves, trying desperately to intercept the intelligence and sensations so they might bring it under control. Oxygen was pulled from the separators to cool the tunnels where Commander Lassen's troops worked.
Yes?
Sir, we phased the interrogative feedback. We're ready to try for an image on the visual screens.
Excellent.
What about vocal auditory?
Completely phased. We haven't broken the speech code yet, but all sounds are clearly audible.
Blast that crossbeat. Can't the crews do something to muffle it?
We're trying. We don't dare go into the main arteries. Not yet, at least.
Have they calcified?
They're trying, Zerim. We've got calcification crews working like demons trying to harden the central blood vessels.
Very well. Lieutenant, is the screen ready?
Yes, sir. Does the commander wish to monitor himself?
Yes. These are standard controls, I assume?
Yes, sir. Focus is this knob. Brightness control is at the right.
Very good. Now, switch on and we'll see if we can see what this creature sees. A little more focus.
Something's coming through.
It isn't a clear enough image. Bring up the contrast. There.
Well?
It appears that our host is in an enclosed space of some sort. From the orderly flow of articles across the screen, I would say it was moving. Aimlessly. As an item for resting on, it appears. In the background, a blurred pattern of light and dark stripes. Now, let's hear the auditory reception. May as well get the decoding section working on it.
I'll switch it on, sir. The creature doesn't seem to be vocalizing.
Now, what's the noise?
I believe that's a respiratory sound, sir, made by the creature's oxygen plant.
Well, try to eliminate it. Filter it out.
Yes, sir.
Doc, I tell you, I'm sick.
It's vocalizing.
I'm not trying to pull anything, Doc. There's something wrong inside me. Honest. Doc, please.
Try to break down the pattern. I want to know what the creature is communicating.
Yes, sir.
Well, Parrock, do you still think we should turn back?
We've tapped into the creature's communication system, Zerim. I think controlling it is going to be another matter.
Inside the subject, the work continued hour after hour, day after day. Inside the control room, Commander Lassen was haggard and weary. Outside, the crews labored in the tunnels, calcifying blood vessels, tapping into sensory nerves, tying circuits across sympathetic nerve fibers, and still no positive control.
Is that him?
Oh, Eric. What's happening?
Well, we're making slow progress, Zerim. Between the heat and the cross pulse, the men are beginning to crack up. They need a rest.
Anyone caught loafing on the job will be fed into the disposal units. Those are my orders.
Isn't that a bit harsh?
Are you questioning my authority?
Yes, I think you've been working too hard.
I'll have you... Listen.
The silence. They've done it. Modification section has muffled the crossbeat.
You're right.
What a relief. Come on, let's try the audiovisual again. Maybe we'll be able to hear something now.
There's a picture coming in.
It's the same picture. Blurry, barred pattern. Objects for sitting and reclining. Switch on the auditory.
Right. It's vocalizing.
Listen.
I guess I didn't. It happened all of a sudden. This pain in my heart. Like it slowed down. Sick. There's something wrong with me.
If only decoding would crack the speech pattern so we knew what it was saying.
There seems to be another macro-organism in the room with it. Dressed in white, it seems.
Yes, I see.
I'm not thinking, Doctor. You better do something.
I want the speech pattern given number one priority. No time for... That's condition red.
Commander, the vein is ruptured in tunnel C. There's a leukocyte breakthrough.
Get the guns. I want a coagulant crew in there at once.
There are hundreds of the monsters, Commander. Shall we seal off the tunnel?
And lose weeks of calcifying? Come on, we'll try to coagulate.
Commander joined the rush of frenzied emergency troops rushing into the corridor. Ahead, crews were lugging hand sterilizers and broad-spectrum coagulators. Inside the tunnel, the scene was bedlam. There was a break in the wall, hemorrhaging profusely. Crewmen waded knee-deep in the nauseous sea of thrombin. Red corpuscles knocked them off balance. Every so often, a sickening gray leukocyte would rear up and embrace a crewman in a grip of acid death.
We'll have to retreat. The thrombin's rising. Lieutenant, give the order to fall back and seal off the tunnel.
Yes, sir. Fall back. Seal the tube. Fall back.
The struggle continued. New tunnels were formed. More nerves tied into central control. Veins and arteries calcified. The heat reduced to a livable temperature. Slowly, the morale of the shock troops inched higher, and Commander Lassen relaxed and grew more amiable.
Well, Doc, ready for the big event?
Yes, my crew is standing by.
Good. We'll try an auditory visual intercept first, and then we'll attempt to control a few responses.
We've tapped into the creature's hearing circuit now so that we can hear what it hears as well as what it says.
Excellent. Switch on the screen. It's coming in now. And the creature is still in the same room, alone, evidently. And it seems to be writing a message of some sort. Oh, wait. It's talking.
My appeal was turned down. And this is it.
Now, let's try a motor response. Lieutenant Mander.
Sir?
Which circuit controls the organism's right extremity?
This one, sir.
Are all circuits properly insulated against electrical surge?
Up to 1 million dynarcs, Commander.
Well, we've never encountered anything higher. That should be safe enough. And here goes. I'll try a simple contraction. It worked! The right limb contracted. Peric, it worked. We've established control.
You ought to be congratulated, Commander.
Thank you. Switch on auditory visual again. Yeah. The creature is still writing.
Actually, I don't mind too much. The doctors have discovered that I have a serious condition of the blood vessels and heart. They call it sclerosis. And I've been feeling awful lately. So, I'm not too afraid of what's coming. Think of me, love, Sam.
Now, the message is concluded. Let's try another motor response. I'm going to manipulate the creature's legs now to make it locomote toward the barred pattern. Ready?
Ready, sir.
It's moving! Excellent, excellent! Herrick, have the crews clean up the remaining circuits. Make absolutely certain that the electrical hazard is reduced to a minimum. I can't afford to lose any more troops. Now, what about the speech code?
Decoding thinks they may break it any moment now.
Now, keep them working. Give the troops extra rations and pay and commend them for a good job. If all goes well, we'll send for colonists within a week.
Exactly 1 week later, Commander Lassen, seated in a compartment that was now fully air-conditioned, silent, and filled with soft Dalvarisian music, radioed to the Commissioner of Colonization.
So everything is ready. With the exception of the speech code, we have complete primary control of all circuits. We'll expect first 10,000 colonists as soon as transport can be arranged. Lassen. I'll send that at once. Come in. What is it, Eric?
I don't know. There are changes in the intercept screens.
What kind of changes?
Well, for one thing, there's a temperature drop in the upper quadrant of the creature. Then it seems to be changing its surroundings.
Mm-hmm. I'll come out and have a look.
There, you see? There are other macro creatures in the room now. There. One of them has a black robe.
Well, what's so alarming?
The speech pattern of the black robe creature is unlike anything we've ever heard before.
Turn on auditory intercept. Strange.
Look at the temperature drop up there.
Let me try touching the creature's cranial region. That explains the temperature drop. The mat of thread-like growth has been entirely removed.
Look, the black-robed one has moved away. Now another creature approaches.
Our host entity is being seated. Now, bands are being placed on its wrists and legs. That's interesting.
I don't like it.
What are you worried about?
I don't know. It frightens me.
Look. Now a dome-like object is being lowered over the creature's head, a great cupola.
It's cutting out the light.
Turn off the auditory.
I don't want to die, Warner. Not in the electric chair.
I wish we knew the speech code. Well, another few days and we'll have it broken. Then, total victory will be ours. Total victory.
What's happening now, Zaring?
I don't know. Everything is quiet. The creature is waiting in the dark for something to happen, apparently. I wonder what.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. Tonight, X-1 has brought you Shock Troop, a story from the pages of Galaxy, written by Daniel Gallion and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in our cast were Bernard Lenro as Commander Lassen, Edwin Cooper as Perak, John Thomas as Mandor, Ralph Camargo as Sam, and Roger DeCoven was the narrator. This is Fred Collins speaking. X-1 was directed by George Boutsas and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Whoa, that was short. Only 16 minutes. What must have happened here is something that I've seen before, where X-1 was repeated years after its original production on a program that often butchered the original in order to add more commercial time And some more time for the current host to just sort of inanely prattle along. Now, I'm not completely out of sympathy with inanely prattling along. I mean, I do that. And I have to admit that in this case, what was left was a pretty tight little story. By the way, Daniel F. Kaluuya, who was born on February 11th of 1920 and would die on September the 7th, 1976, was an American science fiction writer who during the 50s and 60s contributed a number of novelettes and short stories to various digest-sized science fiction magazines. Well, you know, like Galaxy. He only wrote, I think, 6 novels. I remember his writings quite well, and remember being particularly impressed with a 1961 novel, Dark Universe. It's a good novel. It's one of those post-apocalyptic novels that in my mid-teens I was so fond of. I discovered that what must be an uncirculated copy of the 1961 paperback edition is available for purchase on Amazon for $329. You can buy a used paperback for $40. I probably paid 35, maybe 50 cents in 1961. Should have held on to that. But then I should have held on to a lot of things I once owned. In 1977, when I moved from San Jose, California, to Portland, Oregon, I looked at my library and I said, I've been carrying this stuff around for years. There are boxes and boxes of this. There are 2,000 books here. I should do something about this. I mean, do I own them or do they own me? Dumb move. You should never sell anything you love.
Keep out. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Megan Argo. Keep Out by Frederick Brown. With no more room left on Earth, and with Mars hanging up there, empty of life, somebody hit on the plan of starting a colony on the Red Planet. It meant changing the habits and physical structure of the immigrants, but it worked out fine. In fact, every possible factor was covered, except one of the flaws of human nature. Daptine is the secret of it. Adaptine, they called it at first, then it got shortened to daptine. It let us adapt. They explained it all to us when we were 10 years old. I guess they thought we were too young to understand before then, although we knew a lot of it already. They told us just after we landed on Mars. You're home, children, the head teacher told us after we had gone into the glassite dome they built for us there. And he told us there'd be a special lecture for us that evening, an important one that we must all attend. And that evening he told us the whole story, and the whys and wherefores. He stood up before us. He had to wear a heated spacesuit and helmet, of course, because the temperature in the dome was comfortable for us, but already freezing cold for him, and the air was already too thin for him to breathe. His voice came to us by radio from inside his helmet. Children, he said, you are home. This is Mars, the planet on which you will spend the rest of your lives. You are Martians, the first Martians. You have lived 5 years on Earth and another 5 in space. Now you will spend 10 years until you are adults in this dome, although toward the end of that time you will be allowed to spend increasingly long periods outdoors. Then you will go forth and make your own homes, live your own lives, as Martians. You will intermarry and your children will breed true. They too will be Martians. It is time you were told the history of this great experiment of which each of you is a part. Then he told us. Man, he said, had first reached Mars in 1985. It had been uninhabited by intelligent life. There is plenty of plant life and a few varieties of non-flying insects. And he had found it, by terrestrial standards, uninhabitable. Man could survive on Mars only by living in glassite domes and wearing spacesuits when he went outside of them. Except by day in the warm seasons, it was too cold for him. The air was too thin for him to breathe, and long exposure to sunlight, less filtered of rays harmful to him than on Earth because of the lesser atmosphere, could kill him. The plants were chemically alien to him, and he could not eat them. He had to bring all his food from Earth or grow it in hydroponic tanks. For 50 years he had tried to colonize Mars, and all his efforts had failed. Besides this dome which had been built for us, there was only one other outpost, another glassite dome, much smaller and less than a mile away. It had looked as though mankind could never spread to the other planets of the solar system besides Earth, for, of all of them, Mars was the least inhospitable. If he couldn't live here, then there was no use even trying to colonize the others. And then, in 2034, 30 years ago, a brilliant biochemist named Weymouth had discovered daptine, a miracle drug that worked not on the animal or person to whom it was given, but on the progeny he conceived during a limited period of time after inoculation. It gave his progeny almost limitless adaptability to changing conditions, provided the changes were made gradually. Dr. Weymouth had inoculated and then mated a pair of guinea pigs. They had born a litter of 5, and by placing each member of the litter under different and gradually changing conditions, he had obtained amazing results. When they attained maturity, one of those guinea pigs was living comfortably at a temperature of 40 below 0 Fahrenheit. Another was quite happy at 150 above. A third was thriving on a diet that would have been deadly poison for an ordinary animal. And a fourth was contented under a constant X-ray bombardment that would have killed one of its parents within minutes. Subsequent experiments with many litters showed that animals who had been adapted to similar conditions bred true, and their progeny was conditioned from birth to live under those conditions. 10 years ago, the headteacher told us, you children were born of parents carefully selected from those who volunteered for the experiment. And from birth, you have been brought up under carefully controlled and gradually changing conditions. From the time you were born, the air you have breathed has been very gradually thinned and its oxygen content reduced. Your lungs have compensated by becoming much greater in capacity, which is why your chests are so much larger than those of your teachers and attendants. When you are fully mature and are breathing air like that of Mars, the difference will be even greater. Your bodies are growing fur to enable you to stand the increasing cold. You are comfortable now under conditions which would kill ordinary people quickly. Since you were 4 years old, your nurses and teachers have had to wear special protection to survive conditions that seem normal to you. In another 10 years, at maturity, you will be completely acclimated to Mars. Its air will be your air. Its food plants, your food. Its extremes of temperature will be easy for you to endure, and its median temperatures pleasant to you. Already, because of the 5 years we spent in space under gradually decreased gravitational pull, the gravity of Mars seems normal to you. It will be your planet to live on and to populate. You are the children of Earth, but you are the first Martians. Of course, we had known a lot of those things already. The last year was the best. By then, the air inside the dome, except for the pressurized parts where our teachers and attendants live, was almost like that outside, and we were allowed out for increasingly long periods. It was good to be in the open. The last few months they relaxed segregation of the sexes, so we could begin choosing mates, although they told us there is to be no marriage until after the final day, after our full clearance. Choosing was not difficult in my case. I had made my choice long since, and I'd felt sure that she felt the same way. I was right. Tomorrow is the day of our freedom. Tomorrow we will be Martians, the Martians. Tomorrow we shall take over the planet. Some among us are impatient, have been impatient for weeks now, but wiser counsel prevailed and we are waiting. We have waited 20 years, and we can wait until the final day. And tomorrow is the final day. Tomorrow, at a signal, we will kill the teachers and the other Earthmen among us before we go forth. They do not suspect, so it will be easy. We have dissimulated for years now, and they do not know how we hate them. They do not know how disgusting and hideous we find them, with their ugly, misshapen bodies so narrow-shouldered and tiny-chested, their weak, sibilant voices that need amplification to carry in our Martian air, and above all their white, pasty, hairless skins. We shall kill them, and then we shall go and smash the other dome, so that all the Earthmen there will die too. If more Earthmen ever come to punish us, we can live and hide in the hills where they'll never find us. And if they try to build more domes, we'll smash them. We want no more to do with Earth. This is our planet, and we want no aliens. Keep off. End of Keep Out by Frederick Brown. Read by Megan Argo.
I know. Another break. Well, what can I do? It's a promise to come back soon. Our next story is from one of the earlier radio programs, True Detective Mysteries, which began to broadcast on CBS every Thursday evening, beginning in 1929. Based on stories from True Detective Magazine, I remember seeing True Detective Magazine on the newsstands. You may too. It really didn't cease publication until 1995. Tonight's episode is from 1937, August the 12th of 1937 to be exact, and is called Who Killed Bonnie Collins?
And now we bring you a thrilling crime detection story taken from the pages of the leading detective publication, True Detective Mysteries Magazine. Our story begins in the town treasurer's office of High Springs, Florida.
Town clerk's office, Miss Collins speaking. Oh, yes, Mr. Britton. Well, that tax payment is due for the 5th of the month. Not at all. Goodbye.
Is this the chief of police's office, ma'am?
No, it's down the hall on your right.
That's Mr. Burton's office, ain't it?
Yes, Officer Burton, chief of police.
Oh, thank you, ma'am. Oh, excuse me, ma'am.
Well, it's troubling you. Oh, it's this job. What do you expect, being town clerk and treasurer all in one? I'm getting a job as waitress. That'll satisfy me. Now what are you doing?
Oh, I've got to fire up the stove before I go out to lunch.
Cheer up. Maybe you'll get an appropriation for an oil burner.
Yes, maybe. This town is still too poor to afford such luxuries. I'll just have to use this enormous wrench and break my own coal and back, I guess.
There. Come on, how about us having lunch together?
I'm sorry, Helen, but I promised Mother I'd go home and have lunch with her.
Well, come on and walk the corner with me then.
No, I'm sorry, I can't. I've got to make a phone call. It's very important.
Well, I'll see you tonight.
So long.
So long. Cherry, 243, please. Yes, 243. What was that? There's no answer. Operator, there must be an answer. It's very important.
Doesn't answer. Oh, my heaven. What can I do?
Hello, operator. Will you try main 388, please? Hello. Hello, is this main 388? Is Mr. Hunter there? When do you expect him? In half an hour? No. No message. That will be too late. Oh.
What are you doing? Oh, don't. Ah! Oh.
What's going on in here? Drop that cash box. Drop that cash box and tell you're on fire. Bonnie. Look at me. Oh, but I got him, Bonnie. I got him for you. Help! Help, quick!
What's the matter, Artie?
Who sent you the gun?
I just shot a strange colored man. He was murdering Bonnie Collins.
What, Bonnie?
Yes, Bonnie.
Is she dead?
I'm afraid so, but maybe she isn't. Come on, will you help me? Get a doctor. Come on.
Artie, now suppose you tell us again exactly what happened.
Well, all right, Coroner.
Now, wait just a minute.
It?
Men, we've marked the spot where the victim fell, right over here by her desk. And here's the body of Lee Walker, just as he fell by the counter here. Now, Artie, you were on duty in your office next door when this happened?
Yeah, that's right. I heard kind of a commotion in here, and I jumped right up and ran down the hall. When I opened the door there...
Yeah, go on, Artie.
Well, when I opened the door, I saw a man. His back was to me. But I saw he was beating Bonnie Collins over the head with that wrench there.
Now, man, you see this wrench? It's a heavy wrench used here in the office to break up lumps of coal for the stove. Go on, Artie.
Well, I saw this man hitting Bonnie over the head with that wrench. And I saw her cash box open there. It looked to me like Bonnie had been putting up a fight to keep him from that money.
All right, then what happened, Artie?
Bonnie fell, and this man reached for the cash box. I yelled to him to drop it, and he ran for the window there, and I shot him twice in the back.
Go on, Artie.
I knelt down by Bonnie for a minute. I saw she was hurt pretty bad, and then I ran out. I got Landy Chew and Abe Deloach, and they came back with me and helped me to get a hold of Dr. Good.
Victim taken to Lakeshore Hospital. All right, Darcy. Now, when did you first know it was Lee Walker you'd shot?
Well, after we first looked after Bonnie, why, we turned this feller over so we saw his face.
Surprised to find it's Lee Walker, huh?
I sure was. One of the best-natured fellas you ever want to meet. Why, he'd want to murder town clerk and treasurer for a few dollars.
Never mind, Artie. I know how you feel. You saw a hold-up murder going on. The man, the chief of police, you did your duty.
Well, I guess that's the way to figure it out, yeah.
Well, man, this coroner's jury, are you prepared to render a verdict?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chew, what's your verdict?
That Bonnie Collins met death at the hands of Lee Walker in the commission of a robbery.
Verdict of death at the hands of Lee Walker during the commission of a robbery.
Coroner, the boys have been talking it over, and we'd like it to go into the records that the coroner's jury congratulates Chief of Police Artie Burton for his prompt action in killing the man who murdered Bonnie Collins.
And we'd like you to know, Chief Burton, that the citizens of High Springs consider your prompt action most praiseworthy.
Oh, shucks, Mr. Judson. I only did my duty, that's
Judson,
all.
Judson, another batch of telegrams for Artie.
Well, don't open them now.
Oh, quite the contrary. We are going to open them now. Here, Abe, you help me. Come on, boys, help us open these telegrams. Let's see. Congratulations to you and your community.
Another hero has been added to police roll of honor.
Florida should be proud of Chief of Police Arthur Burton.
Would you consider position training candidate?
Speediest justice I've ever known. Congratulations.
Now, what do you think of that? What do you think of that, Artie?
Oh, shucks, I told you I was only doing my duty, that's all.
You're too modest, Artie. Now, what do you think about it, Mrs. Burton?
Well, I'm mighty sorry about Bonnie Collins, but I'm glad Arthur was there to see that she got quick justice.
Yeah. Mrs. Burton. You know, Mrs. Burton, I wouldn't be surprised if they made your husband mayor before long.
Oh, go on, Landy. What are you talking
I'm not
about?
One for politics, but I can tell you, you would get a good, honest man for mayor and my husband.
That's a stop, Mrs. Burton. Well, boys, I guess we ought to be going and let Artie and his missus see something in their own home.
Good night.
Did you hear what they said, Ma? Mayor. Gee.
Sure, why not?
I got no more call to be mayor this time.
Oh, that's the door. More telegrams, I suppose.
Well, now you sit right down, Ma, and I'll answer. Good evening, Chief Police Burton. That's me. Won't you come in?
Thanks.
Chief, I'm John Logan of the State Auditor's Bureau.
Oh, yes, Mr. Logan. Sit down.
Thank you.
Excuse us, Willie Moore. This is a little business.
All right, Artie. I'll just straighten up the kitchen.
What can I do for you while you're here, Mr. Logan?
Well, I've just been down to town hall. Glad you locked up Bonnie Collins' office after the murder.
Yes, I thought it might be best, since she was city treasurer and all that. Would you like to have the key?
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's why I came here tonight. Sorry to bother you.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Here. Here's the key.
Thanks. Oh, congratulations on solving a murder case so quickly.
Oh, I don't deserve any credit. Just happened to be there.
You didn't recognize this murderer, this Lee Walker, at first, did you?
No, I just saw a man beating Bonnie Collins to death, and I let him have it.
Lucky you were there. Shot him twice in the back, I understand.
That's right. It was the only place I could get a crack at him.
I see. Well, Mr. Burton, I'll be getting along.
We'll probably see you at town hall tomorrow.
Oh, sure, sure. Anything I can do to help, why, just sound off.
I will. Ordering books after a murder isn't such a nice job. But anyhow, we'll balance the accounts all right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Come on in. My name's Logan. I'm from the state auditor's office. Just going over Miss Collins' books.
Oh, I see. Well, I'll be getting on.
Wait, just a minute.
Yes, sir?
You work around here?
Yes, I'm the janitor.
I see. What's your name?
Tom Smith.
Tom, you know, we auditors sometimes have to ask a lot of questions.
Sure. Not about the murder.
Oh, no. It's just a little money matter. You see, there was $112.33 in Miss Collins' cash box.
Uh-huh.
Now, this colored fellow, Lee Walker, who was killed while robbing and beating Miss Collins, was he around town hall here a good bit?
Sure. Lee was kind of a town character. Sold them voodoo charms, conjure books, and dream tickets.
On the numbers?
Sure. He's pretty lucky, too.
Oh, did Miss Collins play the numbers?
I don't know.
Did you buy any of those conjure books or voodoo charms?
I don't know.
Tom, did you help carry the bodies out of the office here?
Yes, sirree, sir. Both of them. Helped to get Miss Collins in the ambulance and helped carry out Lee Walker after the coroner's jury gave verdict he murdered Bonnie.
Which way was Walker's body lying?
Lying almost flush with this side of the counter.
Which way were his feet?
Right near that doorway.
And Bonnie Collins' body was lying around the corner of the counter by this desk, is that right?
Sure is.
Now tell me, you the Tom Smith who's down here on the payroll for $12 a week?
That's me.
Do you know this Lee Walker very well?
Sure. Known him for years. Say, Mr. Logan, do you think that you could get me a raise?
Well, trying to get something for you, Tom. I won't promise you what it'll be, but it'll be something.
Well, you here already, Logan?
Oh, sure. Been here since 7 this morning. You know what these audits are?
Well, all official jobs are like that, I guess.
It's later than I thought. How about some lunch?
Sure, I know a good place. It's about 2 blocks from here.
Fine, that's fine.
How's the examination coming along, Logan?
Ooh, looks like there might be a little shortage, not much. But otherwise, everything seems in order.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. Bonnie was a fine girl. Regular, honest.
Yes, I know, but I haven't been hearing such nice things about Lee Walker. I understand he was a gambler. Sold chances on a number lottery and all that kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. But I always figured he was a harmless sort of guy. Never thought he'd try to steal.
I'm just wondering if this Collins girl was mixed up in any of these lotteries.
Bonnie? I'd stake my head on it. Why, she was absolutely above suspicion, I think.
Afraid to be positive now, aren't you? Well, come on, let's eat. I'm starved.
Anything else, Mr. Burton?
No, thanks. I've had enough. How about you, Logan? Want some dessert?
No, thanks. I've had enough.
That'll be... You want one check, Mr. Burton?
Sure. My treat today.
Oh, no. Nothing doing, Burton. I want that check. Here, give it to me.
No, sir. No, sirree. This is on me today. Here's the money, girlie. And bring me the change in quarters, will you?
Yes, sir. I know.
Oh, I'd like to have a few quarters in my pocket.
Here you are, Mr. Bye. Burton. Here's the change.
Oh, thanks. Well, now you just watch how I make these quarters work for me.
Hey, what's he going to do?
Play the slot machines, I guess. He does that every day. But Mr. Burton isn't as lucky as Mr. Hunter. Mr. Burton never wins.
Well, he doesn't expect to, does he? Well, the odds are 1,000,000 to 1 against him.
I guess they are.
Oh, who is Mr. Hunter?
Him? Oh, he owns most of the slot machines in town. He's a gambler.
Oh. Do you know Mr. Burton well?
Oh, sure. Gives me the shivers when I think that I spoke to Bonnie only 5 minutes before it happened.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And I think Bonnie had a feeling something had happened to her.
Oh, why do you say that?
Well, I tried to get her to go to lunch with me, and she wouldn't go. First she said she had an appointment for lunch with her mother, and then she said something about an important telephone call.
Hey, finished, Logan?
Yes, just waiting for you. Well, come on, let's go. I have plenty to do yet this afternoon. Oh, how'd you make out?
Oh, no luck as usual. These slot machines don't believe in giving you a break.
I guess you're right about that.
Sit down, Mr. Hunter.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Hunter, I'm going to get right to the point. My name is Logan, State Auditor's Bureau. I'm down here because I've got to examine the books that Miss Collins kept.
Well, I've got nothing to do with this, officer.
Yes, I know, but I just heard about something that does connect you with her death.
Connect me with her death?
Yes. I understand that Miss Collins tried to phone you a few minutes before she was killed. According to the records of the telephone company, she called Cherry 243. That's your number, isn't it?
Yes, yes. What if it is?
Well, that's what I'm trying to find out. There was no answer at that number, and Miss Collins then called Maine 388.
That's my office.
Yes, I know that. Now, Mr. Hunter, do you know why Miss Collins was so anxious to reach you?
No, I don't.
Where were you at that time?
I don't know. Besides, what business is of yours where I was?
Mr. Hunter, what is your business?
Well, I'm a merchant.
Did you know Lee Walker?
Sure, everybody knew him.
He worked for you, didn't he?
Yes, in a way.
And it's... Oh, hello, Burton.
Hello, Artie. I'm glad you came. Say, who is this guy anyway? What does he want?
He's auditing the books.
Is that so? Well, what in the blazes did he make me come down here? And what business is it of his what I do or where I was when Bonnie was killed?
I told you, Mr. Hunter, I've got to make a full report. Of course, if you don't want to cooperate with me, I can't force you to.
Sure, Logan's right. You don't have to tell him anything you don't want.
Then I'm leaving. Don't like this whole business one bit.
Looks like our friend is annoyed with me, doesn't it?
Sure does. He's a pretty powerful man in this town.
That's so? What does he do?
Well, he's a gambler. Runs the number game in town. Owns slot machines, and he has the right connections.
I see. Lee Walker worked for him, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Sold lottery tickets for him.
Oh, Bert, you can do me a favor. I'm going to be through with my examination tonight, and I'd like to present it to the town council for certification before I leave. Will you notify them?
Sure. What time do you want them?
Oh, 8 o'clock, I guess.
Oh, they'll be there. If you want me, I'll be in my office across the hall.
Thanks, Burton. Hello, operator. Get me long distance. Hello, long distance. I want the governor's office. Yes, that's right. In a hurry, please. Well, hello. I'd like to speak with the governor. This is Gask. Buddy Gask. Yes, that's right. Oh, hello, Governor. Yes, this is Gask. What's that? Oh, I have plenty to report. Tonight's the night. Yes, tonight. Positive. Practically the whole town will be here tonight, and I'm going to break the news to them. Yeah, Bombshell is right. Now, Governor, if you want me this afternoon, I'm going under the name of Logan. Yes, that's it. John Logan. What? Well, I think one or two of them is getting suspicious. Yeah, but don't worry, it'll be... Oh, sorry, I can't speak to you anymore now. Goodbye.
All right, people, now will you please give me your attention?
Yeah, we will.
I've called all you people here tonight for a very unusual reason. I was sent here by the governor of this state to investigate the murder of Bonnie Collins and Lee Walker. Please, please. In the first place, I want to introduce myself. My name is Gask, Buddy Gask, and I have no connection whatsoever with the State Auditor's Bureau. Now, for obvious reasons, I used the name of Logan, and for obvious reasons, I concealed the identity of my position. I am a special state investigator. I shall ask some of you certain questions tonight, and I expect truthful answers. If any of you do not cooperate with me, I have the authority to place you under arrest. Now, Miss Clark, please. Miss Clark, you told me that you spoke to Miss Collins just a few minutes before she was murdered.
Yes, sir, that's right.
She told you something about making an important phone call.
Yes, sir. I wanted her to take lunch with me, but she said she had to telephone somebody. She didn't say who it was, though.
Thank you. Now, gentlemen, I checked the phone calls made from this office, and I learned that Miss Collins called two numbers. One was the number of Mr. Hunter's home, and the other, Hunter's office. Mr. Hunter.
Well, what do you want to know?
Where were you at the time Miss Collins phoned you?
I don't remember.
You earn your money gambling, don't you?
I earn it honestly, if that's what you want to know.
Lee Walker worked for you, is that right?
Yeah.
Did you send him here to see Miss Collins the day she was killed?
I don't remember.
Uh-huh. Well, how well did you know Miss Collins, Mr. Hunter?
Just a friend.
Did she ever gamble, to your knowledge?
No, sir, never. Bonnie, Miss Collins is a fine girl.
All right. Oh, Dr. Turner.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Turner, you're coroner of this county, is that right?
Yes, sir, that's right. Been coroner for 28 years.
And you examined the victims?
Yes, that's right.
This is your report, isn't it?
That's right, yes, sir.
Now, according to this, your findings indicated that Miss Collins was killed by that wrench over there, is that right?
That's what it says.
And Walker was shot twice. That's the cause of his death, correct?
Yep, that's right.
All right, that'll do. Now, Mr. Burton, please. Mr. Burton, you shot Walker when you saw him hitting Miss Collins.
Yep, he was running toward that window when I came in. I shot him.
You didn't want him to escape, is that it?
Yeah, that's right.
And then you called Mr. Chu and Mr. Deloach?
Yeah, that's right. They helped me get the doctor.
Did you see anybody in the corridor when they ran out?
No, sir. Nobody.
You sure? Did you see Miss Clark or Mr. Hunter anywhere?
Well, I'm not sure, but I don't think so. I guess I'd recognize them if they were there.
You knew Walker, didn't you?
Oh, sure. He hung around there often.
But when you shot him, you didn't know it was he, did you?
He was running away from me when I came in, and his back toward me, and I just plugged him.
All right, Burton, thank you. Mr. Chu.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chu, you were outside the building when Miss Collins was killed, were you not?
Yes, sir. I was talking to Abe Deloach.
And when you heard the shots, you ran in to see what happened?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chu, did you see if... just a moment. Oh, Burton, will you please open that window? It's very hot in here. Mr. Chu, did you see anybody in the corridor or outside when you heard the shots?
No, don't believe I did.
You knew Mr... What's the matter, Burton? Can't you open it?
No, it's nailed fast.
Well, all right, we'll be through soon. Now, Mr. Chu, you knew Mr. Hunter, didn't you?
Yes, sir, I knew him all right, but I didn't see him around here.
Well, tell me this. After the shots were fired, you ran in here with Mr. Burton, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And he told you that he had shot someone.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, he said he shot a strange man.
And then you turned him over and saw that the man was Lee Walker.
That's right, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chu. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gask, state investigator or not, you have no right to embarrass these citizens. Besides, we have our own chief of police here who caught Walker red-handed and killed him. Our investigation disclosed that Walker had robbed and murdered Bonnie Collins. Why, if it weren't for Chief Burton, Walker might have got away.
Dr. Turner, I'll get to the point immediately. Bonnie Collins was not murdered by Lee Walker.
What?
But the person who did kill her is here in this room right now. Officer Burton, you're under arrest for the murder of Lee Walker and Bonnie Collins.
What, are you crazy?
You must be mad, Gas. Chief Burton's one of the most respected men in town.
This is a real breed.
Quiet. Be quiet, all of you. I know what I'm doing, and before I'm through with you, every single one of you will be convinced. Burton is guilty of murder, understand? And I'm going to prove it.
The governor's going to hear this, Gas. You can't come into our town.
Shut up, every one of you. I'm doing the talking now. O'Reilly. Riley.
Tony.
Yeah. Draw your gun and stand at that door. If anyone tries to pass you, shoot.
Right.
Now, all of you, listen. Every person I've spoken to has insisted that Miss Collins was absolutely honest. Audits of her accounts in the past have also indicated that very thing. After checking her books since her death, however, I find that her accounts were approximately $150 short.
Walker robbed her, you fool!
I'm doing the talking, Burton. Walker robbed her. What happened to the money? You told us that you shot him just as he was putting his hand into the cash box. Is that right? Well, why don't you answer me, Burton? You also said that you shot Walker because he tried to run away through that window. Gentlemen, my investigation yesterday disclosed that that window cannot be opened. If you recall, I asked Burton to open it a little while ago. You all heard what he said. It's nailed fast. Now, Walker was as familiar with this office as any of you are. All of you know that. If he knew that that window couldn't be opened, why should he have tried to escape that way?
If that's your proof, Gask, you ought to be...
Now, wait till I'm finished, Dr. Turner. Let me finish. Walker never tried to run through that window. Now, the next step that really happened. Simply this. Walker faced this door and Burton shot him. How do I know? Because Lee Walker was not shot in the back. That's how I know. Burton faced him and shot him down in cold blood. That's why Burton was careful to say that he'd shot a strange man. Strange man, get it? That's how he put you off the track. And now why, you ask, did Burton want Walker killed? I'll tell you. Your police chief is a gambler. I myself saw him lose several dollars in the slot machine this afternoon. I can prove that your honorable chief of police loses as much every day. You know the salary he receives. Figure it out yourselves. See if he can afford any losses on the modest salary you pay him. And now for the next point. What happened to the money that was stolen from Bonnie Collins' cash box? I'll tell you. Burton stole that money. Because he wasn't able to put it back, he planned what he thought was a perfect crime.
That's a lie, a dirty lie. I never stole it.
Man 200 in a hurry, operator. Hello.
Hello?
Packard? Give me the desk. Hello, Joe?
This is Graham.
Yeah, in the Burton case. That's as that buddy Gast said. And listen to this. Gast dug up a surprise witness. A guy testified that Burton offered to get him Bonnie Collins' job for $50. Said it was going to be vacant. Yeah, he shouldn't have offered that job a month before he killed her. It showed premeditation today, he said. And here's something else that's hot. The governor sent Gast down, not his crack investigator, because Bonnie Collins' mother wrote him and said her daughter's death was suspicious. Yeah. And another thing. Hunter admitted that he knew Burton was a big gambler. Seems that Bonnie was friendly with Hunter and told him that the big shot police chief was swiping dough. Yeah, nice guy. And that isn't all either. Gast found a witness that saw Burton motion to Walker to come into Bonnie Collins' office. He cracked Bonnie in the head of the wrench and then shot Walker to make it look like a perfect crime. Yeah, that's right. Perfect for Gask and a DA. And after the jury brought in the verdict of guilty, you should have heard that judge go to town when he sentenced him. Yeah, life. Well, sure, I know it's too good for him, but what do you want me to do? And if we're going to make that guy mayor, how do you like that?
Police chief guilty of murder. Wuxtry, chief of police, can play.
You have just heard a thrilling story taken from the pages of True Detective Mysteries magazine, a McFadden publication.
Well, that's another fine night transmissions in the can. So, well, it's almost in the can. Before I go, I want to mention that you can write me, if you're so inclined, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I also want to mention that the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, is out there on the internet, and there's a good deal of ancillary material there, more details about the shows, and even the occasional link to go a little bit deeper into the history of the show. Some people actually think it's worth a visit. Well, I don't want to lie to you. Nobody's ever actually told me that. On second thought, why shouldn't I lie to you? I mean, everybody lies to us, huh? It's a wonderful place. Free pretzels and beer. Go, go. You'll like it there. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're whoever the hell you are.